In a little more detail, the modern theory of cosmic origins goes like this. Some 15 billion or so years ago, the universe erupted from an enormously energetic singular event which spewed forth all of space and all of matter. You don't have to search far to locate where the Big Bang occurred, for it took place where you are now, as well as everywhere else. In the beginning, all locations we now see as separate were the same location. The temperature of the universe, a mere 10 to the minus 43rd power seconds after the bang, the so-called Planck time, is calculated to have been about 10 to the 32nd power Kelvin, some 10 trillion trillion times hotter than the deep interior of the Sun. As time passed, the universe expanded and cooled, and as it did, the initial homogeneous, roiling hot, primordial cosmic plasma began to form eddies and clumps. At about 1/100,000th of a second after the bang, things had cooled sufficiently to about 10 trillion Kelvin, about 1,000,000 times hotter than the Sun's interior, for quarks to clump together in groups of three, forming protons and neutrons. About 1/100th of a second later, conditions were right for the nuclei of some of the lightest elements in the periodic table to start congealing out of the cooling plasma of particles. For the next 3 minutes, as the simmering universe cooled to about 1 billion degrees, the predominant nuclei that emerged were those of hydrogen and helium, along with trace amounts of deuterium, heavy hydrogen, and lithium. This is known as the period of primordial nucleosynthesis. Not a whole lot happened for the next few 100,000 years, other than further expansion and cooling. But then, when the temperature had dropped to a few thousand degrees, wildly streaming electrons slowed down to the point where atomic nuclei, mostly hydrogen and helium, could capture them, forming the first electrically neutral atoms. This was a pivotal moment. From this point forward, the universe, by and large, became transparent. Prior to the era of electron capture, the universe was filled with a dense plasma of electrically charged particles, some with positive charges like nuclei, and others with negative charges like electrons. Photons, which interact only with electrically charged objects, were bumped and jostled incessantly by the thick bath of charged particles, traversing hardly any distance before being deflected or absorbed. The charged particle barrier to the free motion of photons would have made the universe appear almost completely opaque, much like what you may have experienced in a dense morning fog or a blinding, gusty snowstorm. But when negatively charged electrons were brought into orbit around positively charged nuclei, yielding electrically neutral atoms, the charged obstructions disappeared and the dense fog lifted. From that time onward, photons from the Big Bang have traveled unhindered, and the full expanse of the universe gradually came into view. About 1 billion years later, with the universe having substantially calmed down from its frenetic beginnings, galaxies, stars, and ultimately planets began to emerge as gravitationally bound clumps of the primordial elements. Today, some 15 billion or so years after the bang, we can marvel at both the magnificence of the cosmos and at our collective ability to have pieced together a reasonable and experimentally testable theory of cosmic origin. But how much faith should we really have in the Big Bang theory? Putting the Big Bang to the test. By looking out into the universe with their most powerful telescopes, astronomers can see light that was emitted from galaxies and quasars just a few billion years after the Big Bang. This allows them to verify the expansion of the universe predicted by the Big Bang theory back to this early phase of the universe, and everything checks out to a T. To test the theory to yet earlier times, physicists and astronomers must make use of more indirect methods. One of the most refined approaches involves something known as cosmic background radiation. If you've ever felt a bicycle tire after vigorously pumping it full of air, you know that it is warm to the touch. Some of the energy you expend in the repeated pumping motion is transferred to an increase in temperature of the air in the tire. This reflects a general principle. Under a wide variety of conditions, when things are compressed, they heat up. Reasoning in reverse, when things are allowed to decompress, to expand, they cool down. Air conditioners and refrigerators rely on these principles, subjecting substances like freon to repeated cycles of compression and expansion, as well as evaporation and condensation, to cause heat flow in the desired direction. Although these are simple facts of terrestrial physics, it turns out that they have a profound incarnation in the cosmos as a whole. We saw above that after electrons and nuclei join together to form atoms, photons are free to travel unimpeded throughout the universe. This means that the universe is filled with a gas of photons, traveling this way and that, uniformly distributed throughout the cosmos. As the universe expands, this gas of freely streaming photons expands as well, since, in essence, the universe is its container. And just as the temperature of a more conventional gas, like the air in a bicycle tire, decreases as it expands, the temperature of this photon gas decreases as the universe expands. In fact, physicists as far back as George Gamow and his students Ralph Alpher and Robert Hermann in the 1950s and Robert Dicke and Jim Peebles in the mid-1960s realized that the present-day universe should be permeated by an almost uniform bath of these primordial photons, which, through the last 15 billion years of cosmic expansion, have cooled to a mere handful of degrees above absolute zero. In 1965, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson of Bell Laboratories in New Jersey accidentally made one of the most important discoveries of our age when they detected this afterglow of the Big Bang while working on an antenna intended for use with communication satellites. Subsequent research has refined both theory and experiment, culminating in measurements taken by NASA's COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer, satellite in the early 1990s. With these data, physicists and astronomers have confirmed to high precision that the universe is filled with microwave radiation. If our eyes were sensitive to microwaves, we would see a diffuse glow in the world around us, whose temperature is about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero, exactly in keeping with the expectation of the Big Bang theory. In concrete terms, in every cubic meter of the universe, including the one you now occupy, there are, on average, about 400 million photons that collectively compose the vast cosmic sea of microwave radiation, an echo of creation. A percentage of the snow you see on your television screen when you disconnect the cable feed and tune to a station that has ceased its scheduled broadcasts is due to this dim aftermath of the Big Bang. This match between theory and experiment confirms the Big Bang picture of cosmology as far back as the time that photons first moved freely through the universe, about a few hundred thousand years after the Bang, ATB. Can we push further in our tests of the Big Bang theory to even earlier times? We can. By using standard principles of nuclear theory and thermodynamics, physicists can make definite predictions about the relative abundance of the light elements produced during the period of primordial nucleosynthesis, between a hundredth of a second and a few minutes ATB. According to theory, for example, about 23% of the universe should be composed of helium. By measuring the helium abundance in stars and nebulae, astronomers have amassed impressive support that, indeed, this prediction is right on the mark. Perhaps even more impressive is the prediction and confirmation regarding deuterium abundance, since there is essentially no astrophysical process, other than the Big Bang, that can account for its small but definite presence throughout the cosmos. The confirmation of these abundances, and more recently that of lithium, is a sensitive test of our understanding of early universe physics back to the time of their primordial synthesis. This is impressive almost to the point of hubris. All the data we possess confirm a theory of cosmology capable of describing the universe from about a hundredth of a second ATB to the present, some 15 billion years later. Nevertheless, one should not lose sight of the fact that the newborn universe evolved with phenomenal haste. Tiny fractions of a second, fractions much smaller than a hundredth of a second, form cosmic epochs during which long-lasting features of the world were first imprinted. And so, physicists have continued to push onward, trying to explain the universe at ever earlier times. Since the universe gets ever smaller, hotter, and denser as we push back, an accurate quantum mechanical description of matter and the forces becomes increasingly important. As we have seen from other viewpoints in earlier chapters, point particle quantum field theory works until typical particle energies are around the Planck energy. In a cosmological context, this occurred when the whole of the known universe fit within a Planck-sized nugget, yielding a density so great that it strains one's ability to find a fitting metaphor or an enlightening analogy. The density of the universe at the Planck time was simply colossal. At such energies and densities, gravity and quantum mechanics can no longer be treated as two separate entities as they are in point particle quantum field theory. Instead, the central message of this book is that at and beyond these enormous energies, we must invoke string theory. In temporal terms, we encounter these energies and densities when we probe earlier than the Planck time of 10 to the minus 43rd power seconds ATB, and hence, this earliest epoch is the cosmological arena of string theory. Let's head toward this era by first seeing what the standard cosmological theory tells us about the universe before a hundredth of a second ATB, but after the Planck time. From the Planck time to a hundredth of a second ATB. Recall from Chapter 7 that the three non-gravitational forces appear to merge together in the intensely hot environment of the early universe. Physicists' calculations of how the strength of these forces vary with energy and temperature show that prior to about 10 to the minus 35th power seconds ATB, the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces were all one grand unified or super force. In this state, the universe was far more symmetric than it is today, like the homogeneity that follows when a collection of disparate metals is heated to a smooth molten liquid. The significant differences between the forces as we now observe them were all erased by the extremes of energy and temperature encountered in the very early universe. But as time went by and the universe expanded and cooled, the formalism of quantum field theory shows that this symmetry would have been sharply reduced through a number of rather abrupt steps, ultimately leading to the comparatively asymmetric form with which we are familiar. It's not hard to understand the physics behind such reduction of symmetry, or symmetry breaking, as it is more precisely called. Picture a large container filled with water. The molecules of H2O are uniformly spread throughout the container, and regardless of the angle from which you view it, the water looks the same. Now watch the container as you lower the temperature. At first, not much happens. On microscopic scales, the average speed of the water molecules decreases, but that's about all. When you decrease the temperature to 0 degrees Celsius, however, you suddenly see that something drastic occurs. The liquid water begins to freeze and turn into solid ice. As discussed in the preceding chapter, this is a simple example of a phase transition. For our present purpose, the important thing to note is that the phase transition results in a decrease in the amount of symmetry displayed by the H2O molecules. Whereas liquid water looks the same regardless of the angle from which it is viewed, it appears to be rotationally symmetric. Solid ice is different. It has a crystalline block structure, which means that if you examine it with adequate precision, it will, like any crystal, look different from different angles. The phase transition has resulted in a decrease in the amount of rotational symmetry that is manifest. Although we have discussed only one familiar example, the point is true more generally. As we lower the temperature of many physical systems, at some point they undergo a phase transition that typically results in a decrease or a breaking of some of their previous symmetries. In fact, a system can go through a series of phase transitions if its temperature is varied over a wide enough range. Water, again, provides a simple example. If we start with H2O above 100 degrees Celsius, it is a gas, steam. In this form, the system has even more symmetry than in the liquid phase, since now the individual H2O molecules have been liberated from their congested, stuck-together liquid form. Instead, they all zip around the container on completely equal footing, without forming any clumps or cliques in which groups of molecules single each other out for a close association at the expense of others. Molecular democracy prevails at high enough temperatures. As we lower the temperature below 100 degrees, of course, water droplets do form as we pass through a gas-liquid phase transition, and the symmetry is reduced. Continuing on to yet lower temperatures, nothing too dramatic happens until we pass through 0 degrees Celsius, when, as above, the liquid water solid ice phase transition results in another abrupt decrease in symmetry. Physicists believe that between the Planck time and a hundredth of a second ATB, the universe behaved in a very similar way, passing through at least two analogous phase transitions. At temperatures above 10 to the 28th power Kelvin, the three non-gravitational forces appeared as one, as symmetric as they could possibly be. At the end of this chapter, we will discuss string theory's inclusion of the gravitational force into this high-temperature merger. But as the temperature dropped below 10 to the 28th Kelvin, the universe underwent a phase transition in which the three forces crystallized out from their common union in different ways. Their relative strengths and the details of how they act on matter began to diverge, and so the symmetry among the forces evident at higher temperatures was broken as the universe cooled. Nevertheless, the work of Glashow, Salam, and Weinberg, see Chapter 5, shows that not all of the high-temperature symmetry was erased. The weak and electromagnetic forces were still deeply interwoven. As the universe further expanded and cooled, nothing much happened until things simmered down to 10 to the 15th power Kelvin, about 100 million times the sun's core temperature, when the universe went through another phase transition that affected the electromagnetic and weak forces. At this temperature, they too crystallized out from their previous, more symmetric union, and as the universe continued to cool, their differences became magnified. The two phase transitions are responsible for the three apparently distinct non-gravitational forces at work in the world, even though this review of cosmic history shows that the forces, in fact, are deeply related. A cosmological puzzle. This post-Planck-era cosmology provides an elegant, consistent, and calculationally tractable framework for understanding the universe as far back as the briefest moments after the bang. But, as with most successful theories, our new insights raise yet more detailed questions. And it turns out that some of these questions, while not invalidating the standard cosmological scenario as presented, do highlight awkward aspects that point toward the need for a deeper theory. Let's focus on one. It is called the horizon problem, and it is one of the most important issues in modern cosmology. Detailed studies of the cosmic background radiation have shown that regardless of which direction in the sky one points the measuring antenna, the temperature of the radiation is the same, to about one part in 100,000. If you think about it for a moment, you will realize that this is quite strange. Why should different locations in the universe, separated by enormous distances, have temperatures that are so finely matched? A seemingly natural resolution to this puzzle is to note that, yes, two diametrically opposite places in the heavens are far apart today, but like twins separated at birth, during the earliest moments of the universe, they, and everything else, were very close together. Since they emerged from a common starting point, you might suggest that it's not at all surprising that they share common physical traits such as their temperature. In the standard Big Bang cosmology, this suggestion fails. Here's why. A bowl of hot soup gradually cools to room temperature because it is in contact with the colder surrounding air. If you wait long enough, the temperature of the soup and the air will, through their mutual contact, become the same. But if the soup is in a thermos, of course, it retains its heat for much longer, since there is far less communication with the outside environment. This reflects that the homogenization of temperature between two bodies relies on their having prolonged and unimpaired communication. To test the suggestion that positions in space that are currently separated by vast distances share the same temperature because of their initial contact, we must therefore examine the efficacy of information exchange between them in the early universe. At first, you might think that since the positions were closer together at earlier times, communication was ever easier. But spatial proximity is only one part of the story. The other part is temporal duration. To examine this more fully, let's imagine studying a film of the cosmic expansion. But let's review it in reverse, running the film backward in time from today toward the moment of the Big Bang. Since the speed of light sets a limit to how fast any signal or information of any kind can travel, matter in two regions of space can exchange heat energy and thereby have a chance of coming to a common temperature only if the distance between them at a given moment is less than the distance light can have traveled since the time of the Big Bang. And so, as we roll the film backward in time, we see that there is a competition between how close together our spatial regions become versus how far back we have to turn the clock for them to get there. For instance, if in order for the separation of our two spatial locations to be 186,000 miles, we have to run the film back to less than a second ATB, then even though they are much closer, there is still no way for them to have any influence on each other, since light would require a whole second to travel the distance between them. If in order for their separation to be much less, say 186 miles, we have to run the film back to less than a thousandth of a second ATB, then, again, the same conclusion follows. They can't influence each other, since in less than a thousandth of a second, light can't travel the 186 miles separating them. Carrying on in the same vein, if we have to run the film back to less than a billionth of a second ATB in order for these regions to be within 1 foot of each other, they still cannot influence each other, since there is just not enough time since the bang for light to have traveled the 12 inches between them. This shows that just because two points in the universe get closer and closer as we head back to the bang, it is not necessarily the case that they can have had the thermal contact, like that between soup and air, necessary to bring them to the same temperature. Physicists have shown that precisely this problem arises in the standard Big Bang model. Detailed calculations show that there is no way for regions of space that are currently widely separated to have had the exchange of heat energy that would explain their having the same temperature. As the word horizon refers to how far we can see, how far light can travel, so to speak, physicists call the unexplained uniformity of temperature throughout the vast expanse of the cosmos the horizon problem. The puzzle does not mean the standard cosmological theory is wrong, but the uniformity of temperature does strongly suggest that we are missing an important part of the cosmological story. In 1979, the physicist Alan Guth, now of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, wrote the missing chapter. Inflation. The root of the horizon problem is that in order to get two widely separated regions of the universe close together, we have to run the cosmic film way back toward the beginning of time. So far back, in fact, that there is not enough time for any physical influence to have traveled from one region to the other. The difficulty, therefore, is that as we run the cosmological film backward and approach the Big Bang, the universe does not shrink at a fast enough rate. Well, that's the rough idea, but it's worthwhile sharpening the description a bit. The horizon problem stems from the fact that, like a ball tossed upward, the dragging pull of gravity causes the expansion rate of the universe to slow down. This means that, for example, to have the separation between two locations in the cosmos, we must run the film back more than halfway toward its beginning. In turn, we see that to have the separation, we must more than halve the time since the Big Bang. Less time since the bang, proportionally speaking, means it is harder for the two regions to communicate, even though they get closer. Guth's resolution of the horizon problem is now simple to state. He found another solution to Einstein's equations in which the very early universe undergoes a brief period of enormously fast expansion, a period during which it inflates in size at an unheralded exponential expansion rate. Unlike the case of a ball that slows down after being tossed upward, exponential expansion gets faster as it proceeds. When we run the cosmic film in reverse, rapid accelerating expansion turns into rapid decelerating contraction. This means that to have the separation between two locations in the cosmos during the exponential epoch, we need run the film back less than halfway. Much less, in fact. Running the film back less implies that the two regions will have had more time to communicate thermally and, like hot soup and air, they will have had ample time to come to the same temperature. Through Guth's discovery and later important refinements made by André Lind, now of Stanford University, Paul Steinhardt and Andreas Albrecht, then of the University of Pennsylvania, and many others, the standard cosmological model was revamped into the inflationary cosmological model. In this framework, the standard cosmological model is modified during a tiny window of time, around 10 to the minus 36th power to 10 to the minus 34th power seconds ATB, in which the universe expanded by a colossal factor of at least 10 to the 30th power, compared with a factor of about 100 during the same time interval in the standard scenario. This means that in a brief flicker of time, about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second ATB, the size of the universe increased by a greater percentage than it has in the 15 billion years since. Before this expansion, matter that is now in far-flung regions of the cosmos was much closer together than in the standard cosmological model, making it possible for a common temperature to be easily established. Then, through Guth's momentary burst of cosmological inflation, followed by the more usual expansion of the standard cosmological model, these regions of space were able to become separated by the vast distances we witness currently, and so the brief but profound inflationary modification of the standard cosmological model solves the horizon problem, as well as a number of other important problems we have not discussed, and has gained wide acceptance among cosmologists. Cosmology and superstring theory. There remains a sliver of time between the Big Bang and the Planck time that we have not yet discussed. By blindly applying the equations of general relativity to that region, physicists have found that the universe continues to get ever smaller, ever hotter, and ever denser as we move backward in time toward the bang. At time zero, as the size of the universe vanishes, the temperature and density soar to infinity, giving us the most extreme signal that this theoretical model of the universe, firmly rooted in the classical gravitational framework of general relativity, has completely broken down. Nature is telling us emphatically that under such conditions, we must merge general relativity and quantum mechanics. In other words, we must make use of string theory. Currently, research on the implications of string theory for cosmology is at an early stage of development. Perturbative methods can, at best, give skeletal insights, since the extremes of energy, temperature, and density require precision analysis. Although the second superstring revolution has provided some non-perturbative techniques, it will be some time before they are honed for the kinds of calculations required in a cosmological setting. Nevertheless, as we now discuss, during the last decade or so, physicists have taken the first steps toward understanding string cosmology. Here is what they have found. It appears that there are three essential ways in which string theory modifies the standard cosmological model. First, in a manner that current research continues to clarify, string theory implies that the universe has what amounts to a smallest possible size. This has profound consequences for our understanding of the universe at the moment of the bang itself, when the standard theory claims that its size has shrunk all the way to zero. Second, string theory has a small-radius-large radius duality, intimately related to its having a smallest possible size, which also has deep cosmological significance, as we will see in a moment. Finally, string theory has more than four space-time dimensions, and from a cosmological standpoint, we must address the evolution of them all. Let's discuss these points in greater detail. In the beginning, there was a Planck-sized nugget. In the late 1980s, Robert Brandenburger and Kumrun Wafa made the first important strides toward understanding how the application of these string theoretical features modifies the conclusions of the standard cosmological framework. They came to two important realizations. First, as we run the clock backward in time toward the beginning, the temperature continues to rise until the size of the universe is about the Planck length in all directions. But then, the temperature hits a maximum and begins to decrease. The intuitive reason behind this is not hard to come by. Imagine, for simplicity, as Brandenburger and Wafa did, that all of the space dimensions of the universe are circular. As we run the clock backward and the radius of each of these circles shrinks, the temperature of the universe increases. But as each of the radii collapses toward and then through the Planck length, we know that, within string theory, this is physically identical to the radii shrinking to the Planck length and then bouncing back toward increasing size. Since temperature goes down as the universe expands, we would expect that the futile attempt to squeeze the universe to sub-Planck size means that the temperature stops rising, hits a maximum, and then begins to decrease. Through detailed calculations, Brandenburger and Wafa explicitly verified that indeed this is the case. This led Brandenburger and Wafa to the following cosmological picture. In the beginning, all of the spatial dimensions of string theory are tightly curled up to their smallest possible extent, which is roughly the Planck length. The temperature and energy are high, but not infinite, since string theory has avoided the conundrums of an infinitely compressed zero-size starting point. At this beginning moment of the universe, all the spatial dimensions of string theory are on completely equal footing. They are completely symmetric, all curled up into a multidimensional Planck-sized nugget. Then, according to Brandenburger and Wafa, the universe goes through its first stage of symmetry reduction when, at about the Planck time, three of the spatial dimensions are singled out for expansion, while all others retain their initial Planck scale size. These three space dimensions are then identified with those in the inflationary cosmological scenario. The post-Planck time evolution takes over, and these three dimensions expand to their currently observed form. Why three? An immediate question is, what drives the symmetry reduction that singles out precisely three spatial dimensions for expansion? That is, beyond the experimental fact that only three of the space dimensions have expanded to observably large size, does string theory provide a fundamental reason for why some other number, 4, 5, 6, and so on, or even more symmetrically, all of the space dimensions don't expand as well? Brandenburger and Wafa came up with a possible explanation. Remember that the small-radius-large-radius duality of string theory rests upon the fact that when a dimension is curled up like a circle, a string can wrap around it. Brandenburger and Wafa realized that, like rubber bands wrapped around a bicycle tire inner tube, such wrapped strings tend to constrict the dimensions they encircle, keeping them from expanding. At first sight, this would seem to mean that each of the dimensions will be constricted, since the strings can and do wrap them all. The loophole is that if a wrapped string and its anti-string partner, roughly a string that wraps the dimension in the opposite direction, should come into contact, they will swiftly annihilate one other, producing an unwrapped string. If these processes happen with sufficient rapidity and efficiency, enough of the rubber band-like constriction will be eliminated, allowing the dimensions to expand. Brandenburger and Wafa suggested that this reduction in the choking effect of wrapped strings will happen in only three of the spatial dimensions. Here's why. Imagine two-point particles rolling along a one-dimensional line, such as the spatial extent of Lineland. Unless they happen to have identical velocities, sooner or later one will overtake the other, and they will collide. Notice, however, that if these same point particles are randomly rolling around on a two-dimensional plane, such as the spatial extent of flatland, it is likely that they will never collide. The second spatial dimension opens up a new world of trajectories for each particle, most of which do not cross each other at the same point at the same time.